They can be a great people color if they wish to be. They only lack the light to show the way. For this reason, above all, this reason, their capacity for good. I have sent them you. My only son.
My spider senses are starting to tingle.
Just hang on to your lariat.
Wonder what kind of a scene I'm getting into.
And welcome to issue 60 of Behind the Panels, the comic book podcast that's told from the perspective of the average citizen. I'm Richard Gray.
And I'm David McVeigh.
In this issue, DC begins Superman Month, more Guardians of the Galaxy casting news, DC's Forever Evil Month, and all the latest headlines, plus our kick-ass pick of the week, Marvels by Kurt Busiek and Alex Ross. This is Behind the Panels.
Stronger than a whale, he can swim anywhere.
He can breathe underwater and go flying through the air.
The noble submariner, rips up the deep, will be wearing any demon.
Lord Famer of Atlantis is the prince of the deep.
I haven't heard that for a while.
No, we haven't heard that since about, I think about issue 10 or
something like that.
And you may be wondering why.
Well, if you've read Marvels, there won't be any guessing why. And if you haven't read Marvels before the show, you'll want to read it after this show because we're going to gush about it for a while.
And yeah, we're going to pre-warn you right now, a good 45 minutes or what is it, half an hour before we actually start talking about this. There's going to be a lot of spoilers in here, people. All right, we say spoilers and all, we mean it for this one because we've got to talk about this.
This is Comics 101, people.
Absolutely.
But because this goes back, and this is one of the beautiful things about Marvels, is that it goes back through the history of the Marvel Universe. And it goes back and looks at all those classic golden moments. And something that I like to do every week when we look at the vintage clip of the week. So without any further ado, I'm going to hit up the Wayback Machine, David. Wish me luck.
Good luck.
Well, Johnny wanted the anonymity of the Bowery, and for his two bits, he shared a room with 15 other men, all similarly inclined.
Well, it ain't the Waldorf, but I'll be safe here while I plan my next move.
Hey, pal, could I see that comic book over there?
Sure, Mac. Here you go.
Submariner. I remember someone talking about him. He was the world's most unusual character. He lived underwater and was as strong as 10 men.
I wonder what happened to him. He was supposed to be immortal.
You know about Submariner?
What? Oh, yeah.
You got a bum over here who's as strong as that guy's supposed to be.
Yeah?
Hey, old man, wake up. Come on, old man. You got a lieutenant here. Show what you can do.
Oh, I want to sleep.
Well, I'll leave the old man alone. He's probably tired.
Well, he's never too tired for this. Come on, you mangy bum. Get his phone book in here.
Go away, you puny frame.
Let's teach him a lesson, boys.
Get him. Hobbin spoiler for a good fight.
I said, go away, all of you. I'm tired of showing my strength. I just want to remember who I am, what I am. I've spent so many years here in this fog, my mind's a blank.
Guard is down.
How's our chance?
Yeah, I never like to creep anyway.
Hold it. Leave him alone. Can't you see he's sick? He's got amnesia. Loss of memory. He doesn't even know who he is.
Yeah, but we'll beat him back in him.
Wait a second. I've got an easier way. First, let's show him what he really looks like. Let's give him a hot shave. Flame on. I can control my torch flame to within a hair's width. Look at his face.
It can't be. It is. It's Submariner.
Oh, my gosh.
Can I just say that if you are as filthy-minded as me, the sexual innuendo in that clip is phenomenal.
We got 15 other men who think the same way.
Again, can I also point out where they say, we have a bum over here? And then he goes, I'm never too tired for this.
I think the one thing that all of these clips that we've played have got in common are the sexual innuendo.
Oh, yeah.
This,
wow.
You might recognize that voice because we played a clip from that way, 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 way back, probably even the very, very earliest episodes of Behind the Panels. Go check it out on the website. That was the voice that you heard in there playing Johnny Storm, the Human Torch, with Bill Murray.
I know, it's amazing.
Pre-Saturday Night Live.
Now, I didn't recognize him the first time you played this clip. This is way, way, way back. And now I'm here listening for it. You can hear him there.
Absolutely, you can see. And it was in the other one that we actually, by coincidence, and I wasn't even doing this intentionally, I pulled a clip from the same episode. But there's about 10 of those. You can find them freely online. Just to search for Bill Murray Fantastic Four and you'll find 10 of these audio episodes that are all about 30, 40 minutes.
And they're all what, they're early 70s, late 60s?
75. They're all 75. Yeah. So that was episode, as you can probably hear, that was an episode with the Submariner in it, which is Human Torch, Submariner, different Human Torch, but very much two people.
Well, this Human Torch is also featured.
That's true. Both feature in Marvels, which we're doing this week. But look, there's just a wealth of Marvel stuff out there that has been forgotten for the ages. Mm. And it's like people have rediscovered the fact that Bill Murray once played Johnny Storm. You know? Remember that, people.
Life before Saturday Night Live.
Yeah. But there's not been much life in Saturday Night Live for a few years.
Yeah, that's true.
Zing!
Woo!
Well, this show is moving forward. We have been reading things other than Marvels this week. I've been
not a whole lot.
Speak for yourself, sir. But I'm going to hit up another type of machine. I'm going to hit up the What We've Been Reading machine.
Well, looks like we got ourselves a reader. Read between the lines, bitch.
And I did. We read a lot of stuff this week. We did an interview with Christian Reed, who is best known as an Australian comic book writer for The Eldritch Kid. The full title of that book is, in fact, The Eldritch Kid, Whiskey and Hate, which is a graphic novel he did with Michael Mayer for Gestalt Comics.
Hmm.
Michael Meyer, rather.
Yeah, because he corrected us.
He corrected us, and I kept pronouncing it Mayer. It's basically a sort of supernatural western, and that's an excellent. I quite enjoyed it. But I'm a sucker for everything western, basically, and I love the idea of a world in which magic and westerns, combine. And apparently there is a sequel to that coming out. I also read his novel, which is not a comic, but the artwork of the cover of that is done by comic book artist Justin Randall as well. But it's a book called Black City, which we talk about. Have a look for our interview with him where he talks about that at length. The book I do want to talk about a great deal is a book I've been looking forward to for ages called The Wake.
Yeah, now I haven't had a chance to read this yet. I'm so hanging out to read
and,
this.
And I cannot recommend this book enough. I mean, you just listen to the names of the creators on there. The writer is Scott Snyder.
Oh, yes.
So we're going to read everything he writes, ever, because he's
awesome. Absolutely.
The artist is Sean Murphy, who is probably one of the hottest artists in comics right now. Probably one of the most interesting writers, I think.
And if the name is familiar, we've actually covered his work before.
On Punk Rock Jesus, yeah. Which he wrote and drew. Our good friend Nima Afshar, who's been on the show before, described, in fact, I may be actually using his words in describing Sean Murphy as one of the hottest artists right now, and I don't want to misquote him, but I absolutely agree with him. He is an amazing artist doing amazing things, and this is a great creator-owned series. One of the things I found out when I actually picked up the issue I didn't know in advance was that the colours on the book are done by Matt Hollingsworth, who's doing the amazing colour work on Hawkeye at the moment.
This is just a dream team, isn't it?
It's phenomenal. This is put out by Image Comics. Issue 1's out. It's a 10-issue maxi series. This is the shiznit, people. This is this is what creator-owned comics were created for. Yeah. Like, you know, this is why we support them, and this is why we go out and buy their Batman books and keep them, giving them a steady paycheck so they can go and do this stuff. Mm.
Absolutely.
This is phenomenal. This is what you have to go and see.
I will report back on this next week because I am going to sit down and read it. This week has been so busy with, quite frankly, big books.
Can I just mention one other massive book that came out, which was Brian Wood and Olivier Coipel, I think you pronounce it, their reboot of X-Men, which is the all-female X-Men team.
Yep.
That came out this week as well. And I actually quite liked it. People have been completely divided on the book, but it was just a great action-packed issue that sort of reintroduced, in a lot of ways, a lot of these female characters because they'd not had a limelight for a while. People like Kitty Pryde and Rogue came back in a big way, and Storm stepped up to the plate, and things like that. And just and it's the cutest kid possible in this series, and it looks like it's going to be a good one. And a few, and it touches on some of the Claremont stuff, and it touches on some of the Grant Morrison stuff. It kind of brings those things in it. Only word of warning is that if you aren't a huge X-Men fan, you're going to be a little lost.
Oh, really? Okay. So, well, I'm a big X-Men fan, so that's good. I actually did read your review on the site and was very impressed with the rating you gave it. So,
The rating I gave The Wake was massive. I think I gave that full marks, and I gave X-Men slightly less. Both of them first issues. So, like, you know, there's only so much you can tell from a first issue, but both of them are on a very solid foundation. So check them out.
Mine's not a first issue, but the one thing, other than The Eldritch Kid, which we also read, and you can listen to our interview to find out more about that, and Marvels, which is an amazingly huge book. I also read the latest issue of Powers, Powers issue 4.
This is Powers Bureau?
Powers Bureau. This is the new series where they're now federal agents. It's treading water a little bit. It's
written by Brian Michael Bendis.
Written by Brian Michael Bendis, and it's still one of my favorite books to read. It's one of the ones I pick up and read almost immediately when I get it. But I got to say that after four volumes, I mean, this is the fourth volume of Powers, effectively, we might be starting to reach the bottom of the well.
Yeah,
just a little bit.
The thing I find about Bendis's writing, and this is a big generalization because he's done some phenomenal stuff. So, but I think lately he's stretched himself a little too thin, and some of the work's starting to suffer, particularly on some of those longer arcs.
You'd be mentioning Age of Ultron.
Age of Ultron, which we're reaching the penultimate issue, I think, this week. By the time this recording goes out, issue 9 will be on the stands. Guardians, I'm still not actually convinced by, and maybe that's because I'm just so in love with the DNA run on Guardians. Guardians, I actually read a perfect comment about that because someone was talking about the Guardians casting, which we'll talk about a little later in the show, and saying, where do I jump in? Where do I jump in for the comics? And another poster said, you know, the comics have actually been quite schizophrenic in the portrayal of these characters, so it's sort of hard to know what take the movies will use because there hasn't been really a consistent take on these characters.
It looks like, quite frankly, it looks like the Guardians movie is kind of going into the DNA run.
It's going to go
not
DNA
the Annihilation, run. Not any of that, but the but DNA
it,
run.
It sounds like they're pulling on elements of the old school Guardians as well, and having there's a people suspect a bit of the Korvac saga might end up in there as well. So who knows? But come you know, end of 2014, we're going to have the biggest cast ever on a thing. I don't think Disney want this to fail. So
more and more people are now starting to be pulled into this, as we're going to find out soon. So it looks like the cameras are about to start. We're going to have a trailer by the end of the year.
I think they start shooting around July-ish. So I think,
and we still haven't heard who's voicing Rocket.
I'll do it if no one else wants it.
That's the news we're all waiting to hear.
The other thing, I'll mention quickly that I have watched rather than read is Superman Unbound, but we'll talk it, which is the DC Animated Universe original
film. Because next week is Superman week for us.
Yes, we're going to be doing an all-star Superman issue. Well, because this is Superman month, people.
Yeah.
We'll talk about that in more detail then and give David a chance to catch up on that a bit more. And we'll have a special guest in here, our good friend Dave Longo. So,
and I'm sure he'll want to have something to say about it
as well. Absolutely. So we'll talk about that next week. For now, David, I think it's time. I should say for all of our reviews, hit up behindthepanels.net and hit on reviews at the top of the page. Yep. You can also find us on comicbookroundup.com, where you can compare what critics say from all over the web.
Fantastic.
And now it's time for the news.
DC has declared June Superman Month. To celebrate the 75th birthday, there will be the new Superman Unchained comic and, of course, the Man of Steel film. A new short animated film from Zack Snyder and Bruce Timm has also been announced.
Both Glenn Close and former Doctor Who companion Karen Gillan were announced for Guardians of the Galaxy. Gillan is to play the lead female villain, while Close will play a leadership role within the Nova Corps. World mind, anyone?
Benicio del Toro has also been cast as a lead in the film, in an undisclosed role that is said to be locked in for several Marvel films. Adam Warlock, perhaps?
It's very intriguing. Patrick Stewart spoke at the Comic Palooza about X-Men Days of Future Past. Here's a little clip from that.
It must be, 6-7 years since X-Men 3, when you will recall, I hope you will recall, I certainly do, that Charles Xavier was vaporized by, what's her name? Jean Grey. And you are asking yourselves, well, if you were vaporized, how can you be in the next X-Men movie? Anybody got any ideas how that came about?
Time travel!
Yeah, right, that's exactly.
He also gave an inspiring speech about combating domestic violence at the same time, and I really urge you to go and check that out online. We have the clip on our site.
And apparently ate his first piece of pizza this week as well. Go figure. All right. Thor the Dark World composer Carter Burwell has left the production due to creative differences.
He's about the third person to do that. Iron Man 3 has now grossed $1.18 billion worldwide, making it the fifth highest grossing film of all time.
Woohoo! Australia's rugby league team, the Melbourne Storm, will be wearing and selling limited edition Man of Steel jerseys for a game at the end of June. Hang on, sell out? No, what?
Speaking of selling out, DC have announced that September is Forever Evil. In addition to a new 7-issue miniseries of the same name and several tie-ins, the villains are taking over the main titles for the month with, wait for it, 3D motion covers. Now, David, we've seen a few gimmicks from DC since the launch of the New 52. Is this the latest in a long line of them?
Sorry, I've just thrown up in my mouth a little bit.
Yeah, look, this frightens me because DC were doing a few right things the last few months, and they've had some really nice tight little events. They've had the big build up to the end of the Green Lantern thing, which was fantastic. They've had the Batman's done the Court of Owls, Night of Owls thing, and then the death of the family, and that was nice. Some of the events didn't work.
Hell on Earth,
exactly. But that was self-contained within those Superman books. This is, and then we've got Trinity War coming up, which promises to be the next big thing that's tying together some of the themes that have been lingering around since Flashpoint.
Now, that's only through the Justice League.
That's in the Justice League books, but that's bringing in Pandora and the Trinity of Sin, basically. Pandora, the Question, and Phantom Stranger.
Yeah.
This is meant to be playing straight out of the Trinity War, which is, I think, in June, July, August. It's coming out, and then this kicks off in September. I'm more than a little concerned because apart from the gimmicky aspect of the 3D lenticular covers that they're doing, which I'm sure will look a treat on shelves, they're doing this weird thing. It's not like issue 23 is going to be that. It's going to have issue 23.1, issue 23.2, issue 23.3. This is coming like a year or two after DC actually declared, someone there declared, we won't do that, sort of pointing at Marvel for doing their point one issues, which were jumping on points. These don't seem to be jumping on points. These don't seem to be anything more than gimmicks. Now, I would give DC the benefit of the doubt, except for the fact that in their own press release or in their own interview with BuzzFeed, Dan Didio, one of the co-publishers along with Jim Lee and Jeff Johns and so forth, said, when we launched the New 52 in September 2011, we decided to do something different and daring each September to draw attention to our line and really focus on what our goals are for the year. So he goes on to say that they relaunched the whole series in 2011. They did the zero month in September last year. And this September, we wanted to try something a little different and really explore the villain base and show the challenges our heroes face with every story and every issue because of the strength of the characters taking over their books in that month. That's fine if you do it for one issue, but this seems to be multiple issues. And to give you a bit of an idea of how far this is going, I've hit up behindthepanels.net, and we've had a lot of actual hits on this today because a lot of people are curious to find out what's going on. Just the Bat titles alone seem to be chockers for that month. And, you know, there's already, 13 Bat books or something out there. So if you look at something like Batman, just the main Batman book, Batman 23.1 is the Joker, 23.2 is the Riddler, 23.3 is the Penguin, 23.4 is Bane. Then you've got Batman and Robin, 23.1 is Two-Face. Batman the Dark Knight, 23.1 is the Ventriloquist, 0.2 Mr. Freeze, 0.3 Clayface, 0.4 the Joker's Daughter. Detective Comics does point issue for Poison Ivy, Harlequin, the Scarecrow, and Man-Bat. Man-Bat?
Can I just say it this way? Yeah, Man-Bat. Do you remember Man-Bat?
If you've been reading Batman Incorporated, has made an appearance in there as well.
At this point in time, can I say to everybody, if you're going to be buying this stuff, start saving your money now, because how many books does that now make, Richard?
Well, I mean, just the point issues alone that they've mentioned here, I'm looking at a list of about 20 or 30, and they haven't announced all of them yet.
And that's not even going to the other books yet. That's just Bat.
That's just Bat. There's a few other ones they've announced. Flash is going to have a Grodd title. Earth 2 will have Desaad. Action Comics is going to have Cyborg Superman. Green Arrow is going to have Count Vertigo. They're introducing a new villain for Green Lantern, which is Relic. In addition to this, there'll be three tie-in books. Pardon me. Forever Evil Rogues, and there's going to be Forever Evil Arkham War, which will is the biggest story with Bat villains you've ever seen. So more Bat villains.
More Bat.
Forever Evil Argus, which is interesting because it's written by Matt Kint, who's a good writer as it were at the moment. He's doing a really good backup story at the moment in the pages of Justice League of America on Martian Manhunter,
which
I'm quite liking. Kind of what they're doing
Did
in the main...
Did this only just start?
Issue 3, I think it started.
Right, okay.
And issue 4 has the second part of that, and it's kind of Martian Manhunter's backstory, and I'm really enjoying that, actually. Much of the same way that they're doing the Shazam story in the back pages of the main Justice League book. Look, this is classic gimmickry, and I'd forgive it except for the 3D covers, and more to the point, something a lot of people have commented on, the $3.99 price point on these books, despite the fact the company actually did say that they were drawing the line quite publicly at $2.99 for comics.
Can I just stress two things about this? First thing is, I would rather them spend the money on what's in the book rather than a 3D cover. And secondly, I'm sorry, bringing lenticular covers to your comic book series is, quite frankly, the equivalent of jumping the shark on television.
Yeah.
It kind of says, our books aren't selling, we need a gimmick to sell.
Oh, look, I just
look at it and go, this feels like a desperate grab, you know?
Look, it's some of the creators on some of these books are actually quite good. So,
but there's good creators across the whole New 52.
Yeah, I mean, like, you know, you've actually got people like Andy Kubert's doing the Joker issue with Batman. You've got Scott Snyder and Ray Fawkes doing the Riddler issue. You've got, you know, Peter J. Tomasi doing the Bane issue. And some of the cover artists are amazing. Guillaume March is one of my favorite cover artists, is doing two of them that I know of. Look, you know, great creators, and I'm sure people will go out and buy them. And look, you know, being the completist that I am for the series that I am collecting, I will buy the extra ones. But like you, I want to see DC start getting their core right and not focusing on all this other stuff.
We don't need the Flash, not the character, but the Flash and glitz on the shelf. What we need is just good comics.
Which is something that, and I don't like comparing them too much, but they're forcing us into it, that Marvel have just concentrated on good writers, good artists, pairing them together and writing good stories.
Although they did do a foil cover on Age of Ultron.
I'm not saying that Marvel's...
But they gave up on that.
Yeah, I'm not saying that Marvel's flawless, but this is one gimmick after the other for DC. I mean, we're talking about the Justice League of America launched with 52 different covers. We're talking about they mentioned in their own press release the Zero Month, the whole New 52 to start with, those WTF covers, the fold-out covers only 2 months ago, all these sorts of things. Their market share has dropped by 10%.
And what they don't seem to understand is their market share is dropping because people are seeing through the gimmick.
Mm. And, you know, Marvel has gone up because... You know, I'm reading more. DC fan for years is reading more Marvel now than DC. And that's, you know, they've
and the funny thing is, I'm a dyed in the wool Marvel fan, and for a period of 6 months.
Dyed in the wool, thank you. That was a phrase I got stuck on.
Did I? What? I mean,
no, I got stuck on it.
And here I am, this massive Marvel fan, and for 6 months, I was immersed in the DC universe. Where I was just catching up with stuff, with Flashpoint, with the beginning of the New 52, with Green Arrow, with Green Lantern, and all this stuff. And it's like, for me, it was, I'd never really been huge on the ground, the whole DC universe. And then I just kind of drifted away again. They couldn't hold me there. They had me. And if they had just kept with the quality and kept with the stories that I wanted to follow, I would have been still been there. But what did they do? They took all the books that I like and just jettisoned them and gave us substandard material as its replacement.
And it's funny because there was an issue I was reading recently. It might have been the Justice League of America issue 4 when they were introducing a few characters for the first time. And I was like, oh, that person's back. That person's back. That's kind of cool. And then I thought to myself, we had all of those characters before. Now I'm excited because so-and-so has returned. It's like I didn't have to be excited before because they were
good. It's like we were talking about Zatanna the other day. We were saying, oh, she's making like a fairly big comeback. She's been in Justice League Dark, but she's kind of making a bigger comeback. And it's like, yeah, but she had her own book.
Yeah,
you know, she was her own person, you know, and she had her own book, and she was cool, and she was funny, and it was one of the books I really liked.
Yeah.
Power Girl, you know, me and Power Girl. I mean, Power Girl is made a comeback now in the New 52 in this World's Finest, but it's not the same book, and she had her own book.
My final word before we go into the pick this week is that I have to admire the hell out of the balls of DC to commit to something as big as this and that they've stayed with it for 2 years. You know, that it's almost been 2 years since we've been sitting here.
To give it up.
You know, but I think, look, you know, I was really hoping that the Phantom, that the Trinity War would be, right, we're pulling it back now. But it seems that they're going to continue with this mess. Thankfully, the best books in the series, Batman and Green Lanterns, have actually kept the continuity of the pre-52, the pre-New 52, the pre-Flashpoint continuity. And
with slight modifications.
Slight modifications, but they're basically the same at their core. They're the ones I'll keep reading.
Yeah, agreed.
But thankfully, we're reading a book this week which has refreshed our faith in comics and faith in superheroes. And without any further ado, I am going to introduce you to the pick of the week.
Well, see how you like this.
What is it, Batman?
Whatever it is, it's
the pick of the week.
Published in 1994, Marvels was a four-issue miniseries that made superstars out of Kurt Busiek and Alex Ross. Spanning 1939 to 1974, it studies the Marvel Universe through the eyes of everyman photographer Phil Sheldon. The street-level view takes us from the origin of the original Human Torch, the rise of the X-Men, the golden age of the Avengers and the Fantastic Four, the coming of Galactus and the tragedy of Gwen Stacy. Winner of 3 Eisner Awards for Best Finite Series, Publication Design and Ross's Beautiful Painting, this is Marvels.
What a wonderful piece of music that is.
That was from
Thor.
That's a
Patrick Doyle's soundtrack for Thor. It's this track, Sons of Odin.
And just picking up one of the stories we mentioned in the news thing there, it's a shame that Carter Burwell left the Thor Dark World film, because I would have loved to heard his take on superhero genre, because I really loved his True Grit soundtrack. And
look, Carter Burwell is an amazing, amazing
and
composer.
All of his Coen Brothers stuff.
All of his Coen Brothers stuff. And I hate to say it, because as much as the films are awful, his soundtrack to Twilight was phenomenal.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's probably what he's most famous for at the moment, but he's a veteran, and I can only guess that if he walked from that series, he walked from that film, it was Marvel being unreasonable, because this man is an actual
Well, he
legend.
Probably came up with some themes that he thought were what were useful. They probably said, no, we want rewrites. And he said, bite me.
Yeah, probably.
Quite frankly.
I mean, I'm curious about that film, because he's not he's about the third person to walk from that film.
Yeah.
Anyway.
That's not what we're talking about.
That's not what we're talking about. We're talking about probably, and I'm going to say this up front, because it's something you said to me before we got into this, which was, this is quite possibly one of the finest pieces of graphic literature we've ever read.
Yeah, and that's a bold statement, coming from the fact that we've done things like Watchmen and you know. And
we've done 60 of these now.
Yeah, and we've done some of the absolute pinnacle, some of the classics of this stuff. I had never read Marvels.
Nor
for whatever reason it might have been, I've never read Marvels. And I gotta say that when I read Kingdom Come, and when we read the second one, what's it called, Doom or whatever it's called, the
Justice one,
Justice. Thank you. I fell in love with Alex Ross's art. I thought, and I really want to see what he would do with the Marvel universe. Now we're both collecting the Ultimate
Graphic Novels collection
from
Marvel.
And one of the books was Marvels. And I said, oh, This is one I've heard so much about and I've never read. And so we finally got around to reading it. And oh my God. It's like I sat there reading. And I got to tell you, I am not joking when I say I actually welled up twice in this book.
You're not alone, buddy. This is...
And one of them I didn't well up at sadness. I welled up because it was just this moment. We'll talk about it later. Moment that is so strikingly beautiful in this story and picture-wise that you just sit and go... This is why I love comic books, and this is why I love these characters.
It's interesting because it was originally intended as a series of classic Marvel stories. And it was going to be, the idea of tying them together thematically came about later. And because it was originally published as four individual issues, I can't actually imagine reading it in that format because...
But they're big issues because you got to think, there would have been four 50-page issues.
Yeah, absolutely. They would have been four, you know, proper big prestige-style specials. I still can't imagine reading it in that order, although, you know, there is time gaps in between each chapter. But this is the definition of ultimate graphic novel. This is what you would expect. When you're reading a comic graphic novel... This is the kind of level of quality you would expect from that.
Exactly. The writing is superb. The artwork is unmatched.
And should we say that at the time, Alex Ross is not the ubiquitous presence that he is now? I mean, now he's everywhere on covers and posters and artwork.
Cover art now as well. Yeah. Well, we found out today he also did concept art for the Spider-Man movies and stuff like that. So, what was it? The Enterprise model kit from the...
Because he does his beautiful painted art. We'll talk about that a bit more in detail. I mean, we've spoken about his art before, way back when we did Kingdom Come and how he's inspired by real-life models and so forth. But, I mean, let's start with Kurt Busiek's story. The central theme to this book is... the Marvel Universe as glimpsed through the eyes of the Everyman.
And in this particular case, the Everyman is a photojournalist.
Or should we say the eye of the Everyman?
Well, not yet. That comes later. So basically, we have an aspiring journalist who is there basically at the birth of the Marvels. He coins the phrase
the Marvels.
Yeah, so basically it's the birth of the original Human Torch. And it's basically his journey from... the 30s, 40s, through to the early 70s, mid-70s, over the course of this book. And each chapter is a defining moment or series of moments.
It's actually funny. The way they've done this, and both Busiek and Ross have later talked about how each chapter represents kind of a theme.
Yes.
And they sort of like the first chapter was... something like scientific progress.
Yeah.
And then the second one was the fear of the unknown with the X-Men rising up and, you know, powerlessness in the face of Galactus and so forth. They kept these going through. And I think they're not specific about the fourth chapter, but which deals mostly around the death of Gwen Stacy.
Well, I think it shows it's kind of the humanizing of them.
And it brings it full circle almost back to the point of his realization of what the Marvels were always there for. And he makes a beautiful line in there about they were here to save the innocent. But then there's the failure of that and where does that leave him? You know, where does that believe? He's almost unwavering faith.
Yeah, we start, and the thing is, we start in that first chapter, which is set with the birth of the Human Torch and, of course, the coming of Namor. And what this book does is it doesn't say this is the story of Namor and the Human Torch. This basically is saying here are key moments that were in the Marvel Universe, and then we're kind of looking at those from an outsider's point of view.
It's kind of interesting the way he did it as well. And no matter what edition you get, whether it's an older trade paperback edition or this beautiful graphic novel that we've got here, he said he actually sat down and tried to... He hadn't read the stories before.
No, that's right.
And he tried to sit down and lay out the Marvel Universe as a universe and try and work out where all the pieces fit and read all these books in order. Now, obviously, in the days they were originally written, they weren't thinking of themselves as a Marvel universe, although the Marvel comics are largely credited as one of the first lots of books to actually try and create a continuity.
And that comes from the fact that the Marvel characters were all owned by Marvel. It was a structured universe as opposed to DC.
They all lived in the same city almost.
Exactly. Yeah. And DC was a bunch of freelancers who brought characters in. And so DC had a much more unstructured way of putting things together. Whereas, and this is actually talked about by Stan Lee and other people who have been interviewed over the past, where they say Marvel, these characters were all Marvels.
Yeah.
They weren't freelancers bringing stuff in. You know, it's like, and so they had a lot more freedom to be able to make a cohesive world.
One of the things I liked that Busick said in his one of his commentary pieces in between books was that he, when everybody else was younger, they were sort of talking about who would win in a fight, you know, the Human Torch or Namor. He was talking about, he was thinking about, I wonder if teenage girls in that universe have posters of Johnny Storm on their wall. I wonder if, you know, what do the people think about it? And he wanted to, he really started thinking about, well, what happens in that world that exists? How would you live in a world where superheroes are real? Mm. Which is, it's interesting because this was 1994, I think this was published, if I recall that beautiful voice at the start of the segment. and really, in that last, even though there were gritty comics before, like the 80s really tried to ground comics and make them, you know, really solidly gritty and realistic and existing in our real world. It's not until now that certainly films have tried to posit that same question, which is, you know, what happened if heroes actually existed in our world? How would people react to them? So this is ahead of its time in some ways, but also I think in a lot of ways it's a response to that gritty 80s kind of feel. Mm. It's kind of comic books had gotten as dark as they were going to get for a while in the 80s with your Frank Millers, with your Alan Moores, with people who, you know, really, with the death of major characters, you know, the death of Robin and so forth. This was restoring faith. This was his...
It was a love letter.
It's exactly... I've written in my notes here, David, it's a love letter to Stan Lee and Kirby, et cetera.
Yeah.
And it's very, very much...
It's a love letter. It's a love letter to fans as well.
Yeah,
it's a love letter where you basically look at it and he said, here was a more innocent time, but what if we looked at it with a real life sensibility.
Yeah.
And so we, with our photojournalist, who I've forgotten his name. Phil
Sheldon.
Phil Sheldon, thank you. Phil Sheldon.
Phil Spencer basically would be a completely different comic. Phil Spector would be a completely different comic.
That would be
comic.
Really good thing. I'd watch that.
Yeah.
So basically, he starts off as being a wide-eyed wannabe journalist, starts taking pictures, in love with his fiance and everything else. But when the Marvels first start surfacing, he basically puts into doubt everything he believes. And there's an amazing sequence where he actually leaves his fiance. Yeah. And he basically says, it's a man's job to protect his family. How can I possibly compete?
There's actually a line fairly early on in the comic where he says something like this point of realization when he sees a hero leaping overhead and he says, we weren't the players anymore. We were the spectators. We were waiting for something without knowing what it was.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's the major turning point for him in the book. And he suddenly realizes that his role in this whole thing has changed. And that leads to that darker edge with the rise of the X-Men and the fear that comes with that, you know, Do you know, what place do we have when there are homo superiors walking amongst us?
Although prior to that, he comes to terms with it. And this is what part I thought was interesting. So before you get to the horror of what he feels is this, that one line from Cyclops that keeps going through his head, which is, it's not worth it. They're not worth it.
Yeah.
And he keeps having that one line run through his head constantly. But just prior to that, though, he witnesses like the all-out smackdown between Namor and the Human Torch.
Yeah.
The original Human Torch. Where he loses his eye.
That's right.
And it's at that point, though, is where he basically says he came to an understanding. He basically said, it's not that we have to live up to them or anything. They are not going away. They're now part of the norm.
Yeah.
And he comes to terms with that. And instead of being afraid of them, he gets back together with his fiance at that point as well. And he basically, instead of being afraid of them, he starts to realize that they need to be understood and he needs to follow them and he needs to document them, you know?
And I think what's really interesting, that's him and that's in the first chapter or two. And then when we start getting this other undercurrent of fear, it's when he starts pulling it out and getting the views of other people.
He actually has a line. I actually pulled a screenshot from that one where he basically when a riot breaks out.
Yeah.
Because of this irrational fear of mutants.
Yeah.
Out of nowhere, this riot breaks out. And he actually says, at this point, he needed to document it. He needed to take photos of it, because if he didn't, who would? And he needed to show the world this wider picture, which is, it's not them you should be afraid of, it's you. You know, because you're the ones who are doing this amazingly irrational thing.
That's right. I mean, look, you know, two things that we've spoken about before on the show that I've never understood and you've never understood. It's like, one of my bugbears is, why is J. Jonah Jameson always still so angry at Spider-Man, yes, despite the obvious help that he's giving? And your question, I thought, was always a good question, which is, what, you know, why, with superheroes everywhere in the Marvel U, why is hating mutants still a thing?
Exactly. Everybody, you know, has superpowers. So what is the difference between Cyclops being born with it or Captain America being injected by it?
And the, you know, some of this comes out through, there's a great couple of great scenes with J. Jonah Jameson where he really touches on this idea of basic human fears. The idea that, you know, they think that they're better than me, or, you know, I've got to be afraid of them because, you know, it could be come down as simple as jealousy. You know, I don't have this power.
Yeah.
You do, and that I'm afraid of that, and I'm jealous of that, and so I'm going to act out against that and try and squash it so I don't
Which
have to
Which is
live
a
up
scene between him and J. Jonah Jameson in particular in the fourth chapter, where that is articulated by J. Jonah Jameson. And it's at that point, that realization, he goes, That irrational hatred, that irrational going after Spider-Man, trying to destroy him, even though J. Jonah Jameson pretty much admits that he knows that Spider-Man is not the guilty one.
Yeah.
But he has to blame him anyway. And it's that jealousy of what he's got.
And he really makes, like earlier in the second issue, he really makes the connection between, you know, the civil rights movement and mutant rights movement, you know, much clearer when, you know, the riots break out, as you say. There's a beautiful story that runs throughout that of this little mutant girl who's taken refuge in their house. And, God, this is probably one of the first heartbreakers of the book. This big, wide-eyed mutant girl who takes refuge in his house. And he's already actually made up his mind about – Phil's made up his mind about mutants. He hates them as well. He was actually briefly involved
because
in
Because of the Cyclops moment.
Because of the Cyclops. He's briefly involved in a scuffle with the X-Men, where he's meant to be just taking photos, but he finds himself irrationally picking up a chunk of rock and throwing it at Iceman, hurting him, and they have to scurry off. And Iceman's about to attack him, and Cyclops says, no, he's not worth it, or they're not worth it. And that, as you said, that line haunts him. It's like, are we that insignificant to them now? I mean, obviously, Cyclops meant something else by that, but it was very much a moment where he, all the fears, all the doubts that he had were suddenly real.
Yeah.
And what broke that for him was actually seeing the end result of those fears on a mass level. When riots broke out not long after the machine that was meant to save them, which is the Sentinels, kind of went, you know,
went off on their own.
Went off on their own, and it was funny. There's this massive riot sequence, and everyone's going mad. And he said there was a moment when he realized, he stopped and started taking photos of it, and realized, my God, what are we doing? And then the Sentinels fly overhead, shining light over everything, and suddenly everyone could see what madness they'd come to, and stopped. The heartbreaker moment is him going home and finding a letter from the little girl.
Well, for leading up to that, though, just before you get to that, it's at that moment, though, there's that realization that there's a mutant in his house.
Yes.
That he's now come to care for.
Yep.
And the Sentinels are out there.
And that she's just like his daughters. He's got two daughters. So he goes home and he finds there's a letter there, and it's a real heartbreaker of a letter. It just says something like, "Dear Mr. Sheldon, thank you for everything, but she's crossed out "am," but I have to leave. I do not want your family to get hurt because of me. I took some food. Thank you for the new clothes. Love, Maggie. And that's the end. And then he just says, she was out there alone on this night of all nights, and we would never know what happened to her.
And we don't.
And we don't. And that's the last you hear of her, and it's a heartbreaker.
And then you've got the absolute tear-jerking moment where his daughter comes in and says, is she going to be okay?
And he can't honestly tell her yes.
Yeah, he basically says, I don't know.
That hopelessness that he feels in that moment is pretty much the theme of the next part of the book, which, interestingly enough, was not meant to be in the original spec. Alex Ross says in his commentary that it's his favorite thing and one of the things that he's most proud of, but it wasn't part of the original plan for this book. And this is the first coming of Galactus,
yes,
and the Silver Surfer and the Fantastic Four's defeat of that. This is a beautiful, triumphant moment for superheroes. This is your classic superhero stuff. This is the stuff that makes you get up and cheer. This is what they got so wrong in the movie Fantastic Four, Rise of the Silver Surfer.
Well, the first thing they did was made Galactus a cloud.
Which there's that. I love the way Alex Ross paints Galactus. It's beautiful.
And Galactus is a ridiculous character.
Yeah.
And it takes a really gifted artist and writer to make Galactus work. And Galactus worked in Guardians of the Galaxy, for instance, and he works here.
Yeah.
You know, it's like...
He worked in Guardians of the Galaxy as being enigmatic, and that's exactly what he is here. He just arrives. He's a source of terror. But then in the wake of that, something interesting happened. The public tide has turned. Even though the Fantastic Four are victorious, accusations start coming out that they've faked it. They've faked
staged it. Staged the fraud, whole thing. Yeah. Yeah.
And this runs throughout the last two issues for him, which is the idea that and he actually turns around and says to people at one point at the height of this madness.
Oh, I have that page.
because he's starting to hear, no matter how many times that the Avengers or the Fantastic Four or Spider-Man saves them, people seem to be looking for a way to blame them despite that. They're quite happy to be saved by them, but then they'll turn their irrational fears back on the very people who'd saved them.
In fact, the line is, the people are all muttering around behind him, and he says, "You people, what do you need? The world to actually end?" You know, and it's like he just loses his cool with them.
Yeah.
And it's true, though. I mean, that's the thing. And we see that in our society. This is reflecting our society when things like LA riots break out and stuff. You sit there and go, why do people immediately go into this weird self-destructive phase when something goes the way they don't want it to go, you know?
And blames the thing that they don't understand.
Blame everybody else but themselves.
Exactly.
Yeah.
This leads us into the final issue in here, and he's throughout this, he's taking photos, and he publishes a book called Marvels, which is a photo book and stories to go with it, which for a lot of people actually do restore the idea of the heroism of these characters.
And it's interesting because he actually says in the book, there's actually a line of dialogue in there where his book has become quite successful because apparently the Avengers are off in space fighting war, and so people are now craving that whole concept of the Marvels. They're craving their superheroes, which are gone.
He says, today we buy books by way of apology and eye each other in the subway and say nothing. You know, it's when they didn't come back and we were safe again, we coughed and said it wasn't that important anyway. We had other things to occupy our attention now. And you know, this sort of picks up around the time that Spider-Man has been accused of Captain Stacy's murder.
Right.
And he sets out to...
He finally realizes what his next book is going to be.
Yeah.
His next book is going to be, he's going to actually prove that Spider-Man is not a menace.
Yeah. And going directly against J. Jonah Jameson's wishes. And even his wife is kind of saying, Phil, did you hear about, the menace and stuff like that? And that's sort of a penny drop moment for him. So as he's seeking out... different people to help him make this argument, he speaks to everyone involved, and he ends up speaking to the last person he thought to speak of, because he thought it would be too painful, was Captain Stacy's daughter, Gwen.
Well, actually, before you go there, though, I think there's a very interesting moment just before that where he actually goes and speaks to the police.
That's right.
And speaks to the police, no, they don't think he's guilty at all. They just wanted to question him because they can't pursue it any further.
And it's just Jay Jonah that's beating it up.
Yeah, and basically they don't even think that he's guilty of this. And that's when he goes to pursue Gwen.
And Gwen is, a picture. This is like, we did the death of Gwen Stacy a while ago on this show, and it was a heartbreaker then, and this... is like cutting open the wound again. And
can I just tell you, this is actually the part where I almost welled up. Because he goes for a walk with Gwen Stacy, talking to her about... And she's quite open about wanting to talk about all of this. And at that point, Namor's people come in.
Yeah.
And these big mechanical beasts come, blah, blah, blah. And there's these beautiful frames with Gwen Stacy standing there because there's water falling from the sky because these things need to stay wet, obviously. And her reaction is she just goes, look at the wings.
Yeah.
And she's just staring up at it with the raindrops falling on her face. And she's got this beautiful look. And that's when he comes up with that line, which you were talking about, where she goes, this is what they are about. They're about protecting the innocent.
He says the Marvels weren't here to win the approval of the petty and the small-minded. They were here to save the innocent, to save people like Gwen.
Yeah, and she's just radiant. And it's heartbreaking because you know what's coming.
And the moment, it is heartbreaking for us because, like, you know, if you know the Marvel Universe, you know that Gwen dies not long afterwards at the hands, well, at the hands of Green Goblin, but also because Spider-Man's actions failed to save her, and in fact may have actually led to
her. But we
don't
know if they did or didn't.
But he kind of implies that he saw what happened through the shutter. He knows.
He heard the sound.
He heard the sound. He heard the horrible snap. And, you know, it's kind of like finally the point where his faith is finally shattered and it's broken. Like this beautiful, innocent girl that he got to know, and the one thing that the superheroes that he believed in, the Marvels that he believed in, were meant to do, they didn't do it.
They didn't save her.
And they didn't save her. And it's a heartbreaking moment because he actually then goes out and he just wants to see normal people. He just wants to, you know, he takes a photo of a young boy because he just wants a picture of a nice, ordinary
boy. Well, we should say,
at
that point, he basically decides to retire. Mm. The end of the book is he just says, I can't do this anymore.
Exactly.
I need normalcy in my life. He hands over everything to his assistant and basically says, you pursue it.
Because he's dedicated almost 40 years of his life to this stuff, you know. And he hands it over. And then the last photo he gets to take is he and his wife and this normal boy, who turns out to be Danny Ketch. And if you're a Marvel fan, you'll know that Danny Ketch becomes one of the Ghost Riders along the way. So it's kind of implying that, you know, this boy will grow up into a new, darker breed of hero as a result of that. And I think that that's just as telling. There is a sequel to this.
But not drawn by Alex Ross.
No, it's called Marvel's Eye of the Camera. What's interesting as well, there's also a book by Warren Ellis called Ruins, which is a parallel book. Or painted art, but it's apparently not by Alex Ross, but it's a world where Phil Sheldon looks at the Marvel U going wrong.
Interesting.
And it's kind of like this story, but in a darker, twisted.
Yeah.
And I find that that's something I want to read. It's really interesting. I also want to read, apparently Phil Sheldon actually makes a cameo in Kingdom Come. He's one of the reporters at the press conference. And,
interesting. Okay.
So he's a character that exists in the Ross universe in a way as well. There's other books. There's Earth X, which is kind of like Ross's Marvel universe version of Kingdom Come. It's more like that because it's the alternate future.
I'm interested in reading this.
Definitely. And it's something we'll do down the track. But look, you know, I think that this is I'm sorry we have to wind up soon because this is one of the most beautiful and touching and faith-restoring books in comic books and heroes, and it's something that makes me want to go and just explore the Marvel Universe again.
It makes you actually want to go and explore all of those key moments.
Yeah, and if you're wondering, some of those moments are Marvel Comics number 1, Marvel Mystery Comics number 4, that's the Namor stuff, Captain America number 1, Human Torch number 5, that's all the early stuff. The other stuff is all available in Philly Major Arts.
And there's all sorts of little Easter eggs in this as well, which I'm sure if we actually read the original issues, we'll find out what they were about. But like the scene with Galactus, there's a long shot and you can see a little Galactus out the window standing on top of the building, and standing next to him is the Watcher.
Yes.
And you sit there and go, what's he doing there?
Yeah,
you
know? Yeah.
It looks like they're having a conversation on this rooftop and you go, why is the Watcher
And someone makes a reference to the bald guy that's there as well.
It's like, what's he doing there? He's not supposed to get involved, you know? So it's all these little Easter eggs throughout it. This is must-read material. If you are at all interested, let me tell you, if you have lost faith in comics, I don't know why you're listening to this show, but if you have lost
faith, like us.
Yeah, well, that's true. If you've lost faith in comics at all, this comic book will make you remember what comics were about.
I couldn't say anything better myself, David. On that note, before we go into the feedback, let's just say this is the most highly recommended book that we've ever recommended.
Agreed.
So go out, buy it in any of its many
formats.
And I know
that's a huge call, people. All right, we're going to get feedback on people saying, no, Watchmen or the Viva Vendetta.
We'll probably read something more. But, I mean, pure superhero book, this is the highest one we can recommend.
Absolutely.
So, David, on that beautiful note, I think we should hit up the girl from Ipanema.
I think so. Here she comes around the corner now.
Thanks, David. A bit of feedback this week comes from John D., who says, "Hey guys, brand new listener here." Something we always like to hear.
Ooh.
"Brand new listener here. I started with your episode about Arrow. Loved your show. I love all things Green Arrow. I'll be at Supernova, so keep an eye out for the guy in the Smallville Green Arrow costume. JD." John, thank you for writing in. We'll definitely keep an eye out for you in the Green Arrow costume, not least of which because I'm the world's biggest Green Arrow nut, except you're dressing up in a Green Arrow costume, so you might be a bigger fan than I am.
And so when you do come up and meet us, remember the secret word, too.
Yes.
What was it? Show us your diggle.
Show us your diggle. or jiggle my diggle or something. And we'll definitely want to speak to you and put you in our little bit of footage we're doing about cosplayers at Supernova. And just chat, and, you know, your voice could end up on the show. Because we'll be doing a Supernova special not long after that weekend. So we're very much looking forward to seeing you there too. And anybody else who's going to be turning up, just let us know as well.
Let us know, yeah, absolutely.
So thanks for that, John. And
what we'll try and do, I think, for Supernova is if we get enough people saying they're going to be there, we might organize a meetup time.
Yeah,
so we'll definitely say meet us at the, like, outside the cafeteria at a certain hour or something like that, so we can try and meet up with everybody. Because Supernova, let me tell you, gets crazy.
Yeah.
By mid-afternoon, it's packed. So we may need to, like, formulate an area.
Oh, yeah, definitely. So we'll try and get the thing. I mean, long-term goal as well, people. We're looking at doing a live show at some stage in the future. Mm. So the more of you we have that we know in Sydney and know us, we can get to turn up to that. That would be fantastic.
Absolutely.
So thanks for that, John. And we hope we've found a new fan there that will be tuning in for the next 60 episodes.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I love to hear these stories of people who have come to us for the first time. So exactly, if you are a first-timer or if you've been with us for a while, make sure you drop that message to us. We need to know you're out there.
Other ways you can support us, you can get to us the way John did through facebook.com/behindthepanels. You can also hit us up on behindthepanels.net. While you're there, you can buy some merchandise from us. You hit on over to the Cafe Press link over on the right-hand side of the page. We can buy t-shirts and mugs, the profits of which come.
And now we have hoodies, buttons, and bumper stickers.
There you go. They're all on there as well. If you find us at Supernova, you might find yourself with a free button or sticker as well. But if you want to support us in the meantime, go and hit that up. Go and subscribe to us on iTunes if you haven't done so already. And leave a comment. Doesn't take you long to do, but it'll help us with our ratings out as well. David, that's it for Marvel's show. Next issue, we will be looking at All-Star Superman by Grant Morrison and Frank Quitely.
Going from Marvel, jumping back to the DC Universe.
DC Universe, and looking at probably one of their most highly recommended things. It was a book that we all sat here and recommended to someone a couple of weeks ago, so it's about time we actually did it on the show. In the meantime, where can we find us online, David?
Well, you can find me on Twitter at David McVeigh, or, of course, over at geekactually.com, which is my main home, so...
You can find me in a couple of different places. You can find me on Twitter at DVDBits. You can find my comic writing at behindthepanels.net. You can also find me at therealbits.com. That's the REELBITS.com for my film stuff. And as of this week, you can find me as a contributor at newsarama.com as
Woo-hoo!
Well. Very excited by that. But until then, David, that looks and sounds like a show.
And a very good one at that.
We hope you've enjoyed it. We hope you, if you haven't done so already, will go out and grab a copy of Marvels and devour that. Or just go back and read it again. Until next week, I'm Richard Gray.
I'm David McVeigh.
And this is Behind the Panels.